I'm Marty Moscoe, welcome to Radio Times. Not so long ago, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were hurling threats and insults at each other and making the world very nervous. Earlier today at a summit in Singapore, they were all smiles and handshakes and a thumbs up from Trump as they signed a joint statement about plans for North Korea denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula in exchange for security guarantees, an agreement that was short on specifics. President Trump talked about a very special bond with Kim and said, "We are ready to write a new chapter between our nations."
The letter that we're signing is very comprehensive. And I think both sides are going to be very impressed with the result. A lot of goodwill went into this, a lot of work, a lot of preparation. I want to thank everybody on both sides.
This was in stark contrast to what he said recently about Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, calling him very dishonest and weak for objecting to U.S. tariffs at the G7 meeting this past weekend. Other U.S. administrations have brokered similar arrangements with the DPRK without a presidential summit, mind you, only to have it collapse because North Korea reneged on the deal. Will this be different? We have three guests who have joined us, and here in our Philadelphia studio is Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's actually dipped her toe in North Korea a number of years ago. Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
John Tierney is joining us as well, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., former congressman and also executive director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. John Tierney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And rounding out our trio of guests is Michael Green. He's Senior Vice President for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also a professor at Georgetown University, and he served as the Senior National Security Council official on Asia policy during the George W. Bush administration. Michael Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael Green, let me begin with you. Are we better off today than we were yesterday? The fact that these two world leaders sat down, had a face-to-face meeting. Yes, they came up with a rather vague agreement, but is this better than the status quo?
Well, we're better off than we were a few months ago when the president was talking about fire and fury and war with North Korea. We're now talking about peace. That's good. It raises the question whether he should have been talking about North Korea war in the first place, but we are better in that sense. It's not at all clear that we're safer in terms of removing North Korean nuclear weapons. There's nothing concrete at all that's come out of the summit. We can talk about what we'd look for evidence of that, but there's nothing on the table yet. Kim Jong-un is definitely better off. He was isolated. Even his ally China wouldn't meet with him. He's now preparing to address the General Assembly of the UN, multiple summits with the American president and the Chinese leader. And sanctions are going to come way off of him. We may keep our sanctions on, but the Chinese are going to back off, and that's 90% of their trade. And our allies are wondering if they're much worse off because of the president's statement, unilateral statement, without consulting with our allies, that we and our allies will stop military exercises that we've done for decades because of the North Korean threat. So everyone's kind of reeling. Hard to find concrete evidence. We're better off, but at least we're not talking about war.
Would you agree, Trudy, that I hate to frame things in terms of winners and losers, but nonetheless, that North Korea or Kim himself walked away the winner from this agreement?
Yes. I think it's staggering how much Kim mastered the art of the deal with dealing with Trump, and the reverse is absolutely not true. When the president, Trump, was asked why he thought he would get a different result from previous presidents who had inked joint statements that were far more specific about North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons, he said, because there's a different president now. And clearly Trump thinks that just because of the personal relationship he has entered into, he is going to get Kim to do something that clearly the North Korean president isn't interested in doing, which is giving up all of his nuclear
weapons. You're saying he's not going to do it?
I have yet to talk to anyone who knows anything about North Korea who thinks that Kim would do this, because the reason the world is paying attention to him is because he has those weapons. Mm. And furthermore, now that all the pressure is receding, there's much less reason for him to give up those weapons than there might have been 5 months ago, at which time, even then, no one thought he would do it.
Well, John Tierney, let me turn to you. And the original plan was anything short of CVID, which is complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. Anything less than that was not an agreement that the U.S. was looking for. Is there anything in this agreement that says that that will happen?
No, there isn't. I mean, basically, the president went from reality TV version of what he thought could happen in 1 hour to diplomatic reality. And that is, these things take years to come to fruition and a lot of hard work and negotiation. And once he realized that, we pretty much had all of the things that are in that agreement stated well before they even met on Tuesday. So, you know, there is good news, as Ms. Green said, that we're not fighting and yelling at each other and that there is some discussion going on. Diplomacy is in gear. But that could have been done without the presidential summit. It was basically a political show for both men, Kim and for Donald Trump, to take home to their respective audiences and show them that something is happening in their view. But really, Mr. Kim got a little bit of security out of this because he's going to have the exercises stop for the time being. He got a little bit more access to global markets, mostly China, of course. And the United States basically got a rehash of very vague statements about a denuclearized peninsula at some point, but haven't nailed down what, in fact, that is, and haven't nailed down any freeze language or even an inventory of what North Korea might have to freeze. So there's much, much work left to be done.
I do want to play a clip, and this is the War Games clip, and this is the president speaking earlier today in Singapore after signing the denuclearization agreement, and he did talk about war games. Let's give it a listen.
We will be stopping the war games, which will save us a tremendous amount of money, unless and until we see that the future negotiation is not going along like it should. But we'll be saving a tremendous amount of money. Plus, I think it's very provocative.
What do you make of that, Michael Green? And it feels as if South Korea was caught unaware.
I am quite certain that Japan and South Korea were blindsided by the president's statement. First, about freezing military exercises, which we've done for decades, so that we're ready if North Korea uses violence attacks, which they have done in the past. But also because of the president's stated desire to get out of Asia completely with our alliances. So, you know, I think in allied capitals, they're going to be up all night and they're going to be asking themselves, is this a kind of a reality TV show, a president who loves the drama and will just put the pieces together and move on? Or is this a president who actually may appear to be negotiating with North Korea, but in fact is putting in place an America First vision of pulling back from the world, including our alliances in Asia? Or is there some possibility maybe this all works? I think that last one, that last scenario is the one that has the lowest chance in the views of those who've done this and our allies. So they're a bit worried about the theme that's emerging after the G7 meeting in Quebec and now with this. And I wonder what some of the members of the president's own administration are doing now to try to reassure our allies.
Well, I wonder, John Tierney, whether South Korea has essentially been sidelined. I mean, it seems like they were the ones that wanted some kind of more stability on the peninsula. But have they been sidelined by these negotiations?
Well, certainly they deserve the credit for getting the ball rolling on this, more so than anybody else. But I think they anticipated it would go in the normal diplomatic course of events and that it would continue to be a stable process, what everybody could measure and have some input on. And yes, they've been absolutely, it appears, blindsided on this. And now they're going to have to react to it. So they've been put to the side a little bit. They're going to have to work their way back in. And I don't know if you can do that with this administration. They are pretty unpredictable, as we've seen.
Trudy, looks like you want to add something.
Well, President Moon of South Korea had been very anxious to get some kind of peace program going, hopefully in the end to end the armistice and have a formal peace agreement, which would have to involve the UN and the United States. And that was something that he had been pushing, but in the background, South Korea wanted U.S. troops and the alliance to be there because the idea wasn't just to be left facing North Korea, because in that case, signing a peace agreement is more unsettling. You want the ally in the background, and then that encourages you to go forward. They have elections today for mayors and governors, and it was expected that President Moon would get a big surge because of this. Probably he still will. But this leaves them in a very strange position. And I think what Michael Green said, it leaves the world wondering whether this is a president who simply doesn't give a damn about allies. The only people he praises are dictators, and it makes you wonder what he would give away if he has the summit that he has publicly been saying he so much wants soon with President Putin of Russia.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, but let me talk to you, Michael Green, and also to you, John Tierney, about the fact that the president said during his press conference very early this morning, Eastern Standard Time, about U.S. troops. There's something like 25,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. He talked about the fact that this costs money. He didn't go so far as to say he was going to withdraw them, but do you think that's an issue on the table?
So this is what is so unnerving and rattling about this. You know, the chances of any diplomacy with North Korea working are low. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe the pressure comes off Kim Jong-un. We still have our deterrence. We still have our nuclear weapons. We have our alliances, our military. You know, we have ways to check North Korea even if the diplomacy doesn't work. But the part that's unnerving is that the subtext that keeps coming out, that the president really doesn't think we should be spending money on troops overseas. And the reality is the South Koreans and the Japanese pay an enormous amount of money for us to be there. But more importantly, we learned in World War II and in the Korean War that it's much better for us to keep our adversaries as far away as possible, to hold the line of freedom, if you will, with our allies over there. And the idea that pulling back is going to make us, it's going to save us money is ridiculous, because if deterrence fails, if the vacuum is filled by China or Russia or others who wish us ill, we'll pay a much bigger price. This announcement on troops was completely unnecessary. The North Koreans didn't need it. And what it has done is it has taken us from the chessboard with North Korea to another chessboard where China is trying to assert its position in Asia, trying to weaken U.S. alliances. And in that chessboard, we've just handed the Chinese a giant victory, because now it looks like this president is not committed to our allies. And the Chinese have been running around the region saying the Americans won't be there. We'll be here in 50 years, 100 years. The Americans won't be there. And that is a huge strategic win for China, which doesn't want to fight us, but is very keen to see our alliances wither and our allies lose faith in the U.S. commitment. Really kind of stunning.
Multiple chessboards. We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Green, Senior Vice President for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. John Tierney, Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And Trudy Rubin, who writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about what many people are talking about today, the summit in Singapore, the agreement signed earlier today between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Let me play something that President Trump said at his press conference. It was very early this morning, speaking about the man that he negotiated with.
Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice, or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000, probably couldn't do it.
John Tierney, what do you make of how the president talks about Kim Jong-un?
Well, it's a little bit astounding and a little bit sickening as well. But, I mean, look, he's making this guy up to be as much as he can, so it'll make Donald Trump look like he's doing better than he is. But he you know, as Kim wanted, was quick to say, they want to forget the past. Well, the past history for this particular chairman and his father and grandfather is not a good one, and eventually we're going to have to deal with that. And that this president, after criticizing the Iran deal and so much else because people didn't take all of the issues into account, to just gloss over that past history is sort of amazing. And the fact that he can sit down and pump this chairman up so that it makes Donald Trump look better after just coming from Canada, where he blew up century-old relationships that we have and that we rely on, is just sort of astounding, nothing short of that.
Do you think, though, Kim can be trusted, or do you think he'll be like his father and grandfather?
Well, I think we have to presume he's going to be like his father and grandfather and then verify everything. One of the amazing things that didn't come out of this agreement was that, you know, we didn't get any verification that they're going to freeze their process, and we didn't get any accounting of what it is they exactly have, you know, for the materials, for the missiles, for the facilities to construct these things. And if you're going to have a freeze be in effect, which we're all hoping for but wasn't mentioned, mm-hmm. you need to know those things. And that the president then just gave up the exercises, which it was going to follow on Michael's point, is that, look, you know, that troops there, the rationale for that is because North Korea is a threat and because we need to be able to buttress our allies. It wouldn't be until after that threat goes away that you would even start thinking about, you know, diminishing the troops there or changing their respect. But he could have gotten away, the president could have gotten away with much less than offering to have no exercises. He could have simply said nothing about the issue because North Korea wasn't expecting it, or say that they were going to have the exercises but in a much more toned down and perhaps redirected away from the regime change aspect of that. But he just gave up the whole thing with apparently without consulting Japan or South Korea. So it's just, you know, it reminds me of his bankruptcies, I guess. You know, he's not the art of the dealmaker there. It's something short of that.
Well, Trudy, let me go back to you. You mentioned Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, who did criticize the trade sanctions that the president put on aluminum and also on steel as well. What do you make of and there are other examples of other elected leaders, that the president seems to be more comfortable, frankly, dealing with autocrats than he is with democratically elected leaders of countries?
I think we've seen that autocrats have his number, and leaders who are willing to lavish praise on him with a keen political purpose are much more likely to get a positive response. If you're engaging in serious dialogue and you try to be frank, including criticism, because his slapping tariffs on Canada on national security grounds was outrageous. There are specific issues with Canada, but the way he treated Canada and the previous remarks he had made about Trudeau was amazingly restrained. And yet the president could not stand the public criticism. It had nothing to do with looking weak before going to Korea. And this is extremely worrying because you see that he is so caught in his ego that he accepts flattery as deserved and doesn't understand the game that is being played. And I think we have now seen between the G7 and what happened at Singapore that we are in a very dangerous era where this president is ready to give things up to China, to Russia, to Kim, that endanger security or that lead us down a very bad path.
Michael Green, I want to play something from Sunday. President Trump's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, speaking with Jake Tapper on CNN. Let's give it a listen.
POTUS is not going to let a Canadian prime minister push him around, push him, POTUS, around, President Trump, on the eve of this. He is not going to permit any show of weakness on the trip to negotiate with North Korea, nor should he.
So this was about North Korea?
Of course it was, in large part.
What do you make of that, Michael Green?
Well, I'm a fan of Larry Kudlow's show when he was on TV, and I hope, as I'm sure we all do, that he has a really speedy recovery. But that's nonsense. I mean, you go into negotiations with an adversary aiming nuclear weapons at you in solidarity with your allies. You don't beat up your allies. That weakens your position. I think he was putting lipstick on a pig. I think the president was mad at Trudeau and ordered his top advisors to go out and, you know, slap the Canadian prime minister around. It did nothing to help us with North Korea. And frankly, The way he blindsided Japan and South Korea with his unilateral statement on our exercises is going to do nothing to help Mike Pompeo in the next steps of negotiating. It's removing the pressure on the North to follow through. It really is about the president's personal, whether or not people are nice to him. The open letter he sent to Kim Jong-un.
The big one?
Going out of talks.
Yeah.
The public letter. Not the big one he got, the one he sent.
Right, the one he sent.
Stunning. Yeah, it was stunning because the reality was behind the scenes, Pompeo and company were getting nothing from the North Koreans on denuclearization. And the North Koreans stood up the president's team in Singapore preparing for this summit. The president pulled out, but the letter he wrote didn't say anything about the threat or denuclearization. It was all about how North Korea was treating him. And, you know, that's a lever that our adversaries are learning how to pull, as was pointed out. And it's worrisome. I think Pompeo and company are going to have a lot of work patching together things with the allies and trying to get some concrete steps. A declaration of what North Korea has would be the right first step. We'll see if he can get it.
That's Michael Green, again, Senior Vice President for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also a professor at Georgetown University. He worked in the Bush administration, Bush 2. Also with us, John Tierney, and he's Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, a former congressman, I should add, from Massachusetts. And Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we want to hear from you, what you make of what was signed earlier today, the negotiations back and forth, the name-calling back and forth. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. John Tierney, let me go to you. Assuming that Mike Pompeo can move ahead on denuclearization, however it is defined, how does that work? Do we know how many weapons, for instance, North Korea has or where they are? Would inspectors be allowed in the country? Help us understand, if this were to go forward, what would it entail?
Well, that's the initial step. You can't really negotiate for something to be removed unless you know what it is they have and what your target is in terms of removal. And that's an amazing thing that we got this far, and we don't have that information or even a promise to get that out. So the idea of toughness, all the toughness that Larry Kudlow was talking about the president showing with respect to Canada after he left the face-to-face, apparently didn't travel with him to Singapore because there was no toughness shown in that. And now it's left to the Secretary of State to try and get in there and be tough and demand an inventory of what is there and some way to verify it. And obviously, most of us should be looking for the same verification limit that was in the Iran agreement. That was the most advanced and substantial verification package of any agreement ever negotiated by this country in terms of nuclear materials and missiles and all of that. And so that's the standard on that. So they've got to go in there, they've got to do a tremendous job, and there's no sign at all that Chairman Kim is interested in that. So it's a real tough bar to meet, and we're going to see it. But if you don't have the inventory, you don't know what it is you're trying to negotiate away.
Trudy, is the Iran deal, is that the template for North Korea?
Well, the whole point that the White House made and Trump made was that they wanted to go beyond that because the Iran deal had a sunset clause. And so it was supposed to be irreversible, complete, verifiable, and irreversible. Dismantlement, the D has stood for different things at different times. They will never get, judging by what happened in Singapore, they will never get what Obama got in the Iran deal, sunset clause or no sunset clause. So I think it's not so much that the Iran deal is the standard, it's that they aren't even on first base. Say the Iran deal is third base, but they didn't get all the way. I cannot see what incentive at this point Chairman Kim has to move forward because every pressure point is being removed, whether it's sanctions loosening, whether it's now that he has promises to come to the White House, this talk of exchanging, interest sections or even embassies. He's now king of the world, the rock star diplomat. They've given him everything, the White House. And the pressure points have been diminished one by one.
Well, to you, Michael Green, is there any reason that Kim would give up his nuclear weapons? And is it a matter of carrots and sticks, all sticks, mix of carrots and sticks? Why would he give up his nuclear weapons?
Well, I don't think he's going to. He presides over a country that in 2012 changed its constitution to announce they were a permanent nuclear weapon state. He himself declared North Korea has achieved its nuclear weapon status. When he says he's committed to complete denuclearization, he's just parroting what the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and China all committed to in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. In Article 6, the nuclear weapon states said we are committed to complete denuclearization, and they did that to get other states to agree not to develop nuclear weapons. And Kim Jong-un has figured out, okay, if to join the nuclear weapons club, I have to put out this boilerplate statement that I'm for complete denuclearization, I'll do it. If he gives up nuclear weapons, he loses his deterrent against American power, but also against being absorbed by China or by South Korea. There's no reason he would do it. The only possible sort of positive scenario you could come up with is that the sort of positive, happy dynamics created with this summit and Kim Jong-un's speech before the General Assembly of the UN and all the rest of this makes him feel warm and fuzzy, and he decides to go for it. I mean, it's kind of a Hail Mary hope and prayer. There's nothing in the history of Kim Jong-un or North Korea to suggest that's the case. But that kind of hope and prayer is about all we have coming out of this summit. The defenders of the summit on other networks are saying that the president has begun a top-down process. But that process is not going to go to denuclearization. North Korea is not doing anything to lead us there. So I think he's not going to. And if he does, it'd be a pleasant surprise. But nothing in this declaration, nothing in his own statements in history, nothing in his country's history at all points to that.
But it's only been a couple of hours. I mean, the ink is just barely dry on this agreement. Go ahead, Trudy.
I was just going to say, to further on what Michael Green said, before the press conference early this morning, there was a video that had been prepared by the White House, and it showed scenes of what looked like it was supposed to be North Korea, and suddenly they had blossomed with high-rises and modernization. Clearly, the president has no clue about the economics or the nature of the North Korean regime. They do not want an open regime, because an open regime would mean the end of Kim. Mm-hmm. So on the and his regime. So they want closed economy with more money, economic zones that they control. So even this jolly idea that the president kept pushing, which is they're going to be rich and they're going to be like us and American private companies are going to earn billions going in there, it's just nonsense. They want to be able to feed the public and have some jobs subsidized by South Korea or somebody else, but not a new. It's not going to be Shanghai.
Well, let me quote something the president said at his press conference earlier this morning. They have great beaches. This is talking about North Korea. You see that whenever they're exploding the cannons in the ocean. I said, look at that view. That would make a great condo. I explained it. I said, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world. Think of it from a real estate perspective. John Tierney, you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I mean, what's to be said? I mean, this whole process is like a clown car, weaving out of control. That is so far from reality, as Trudy said. It just almost doesn't even deserve a response on that. We are so far away from anything remotely appearing on that scale. It just means that this president doesn't have a clue and doesn't have any awareness of what's actually at stake and what needs to be done between now and any time when everybody feels perfectly secure. That's not the point. The point is that this particular chairman wants securities, for his regime. He wants security to know that they're going to be in place and have that. Whether or not you ever get complete denuclearization is going to depend on whether or not this team of negotiators for the Secretary of State and others can ever fashion any security assurances for him that would lead to him thinking he was safe enough to give them up. That's a pretty big stretch. And from there to condos is just nonsense.
Michael Green, I know you have to leave us. Yeah, go ahead. I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. Sounds like you want to say something. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say the idea that North Korea will give up nuclear weapons because of security assurances is not credible to me. The North Koreans do not honor any of the agreements they make, any of the treaties they sign. They certainly don't expect the United States will. And the only reason they're calling for security assurances is because they want to be able to have a piece of paper that they can then wave around. So if we say we guarantee the security of your regime, if the U.S. deploys missile defenses to defend against North Korea's missiles, they can say you're violating this. Or if we do have military exercises, they can say you're violating this. They want the piece of paper as a kind of alibi to steadily weaken our commitment to South Korea and Japan. It's not that they would ever believe the statement of an American president. They only need to look at how President Trump reversed President Obama's position on the Iran deal to know the papers aren't worth much, but they wouldn't believe them in the first place. I think it's basically just a kind of a prop that they would use to put pressure on us to not do things we need to do to defend ourselves and our allies.
Michael, an email from Dave says, I hear a lot of negative reaction to the summit. Do the guests have anything positive to say about it? Do you, Michael?
It was remarkable production value. I mean, as television goes, it was amazingly well put together and colorful. That's about all I can say. If the Secretary of State gets North Korea to dismantle part of its program, there's talk of a rocket test facility. These are not crucial elements of Kim Jong-un's program. Then, or if he can get a statement, as John was saying, of the North Koreans' facilities, a declaration that would be kind of the menu we would then go through to begin dismantling. If we can get something concrete like that, then maybe we can dial down the skepticism a bit, and we'll see. We'll see. Normally with North Korea, you get that up front. It usually doesn't come after you've given them the rewards first. So that is a slightly positive response that there's still maybe something we're not seeing. But from what we're seeing, it's pretty stunning.
Well, Michael, John. Hold on 1 second. We have to take a break. Let me say goodbye to Michael Green. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times. And he's from CSIS, a professor at Georgetown University, worked in the George W. Bush administration. John Tierney staying with us for the rest of the hour. So is Trudy Rubin. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoyne talking with our guests about what happened at the summit in Singapore earlier today. And John Tierney, Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, also a former congressman from Massachusetts. Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has been to North Korea, dipped her toe, I guess I can say that, in North Korea a couple of years ago. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. John, it sounded like you wanted to jump in right before the break.
Well, I did. Thank you. I mean, look, there's three things that Bill Perry was looking for to come out of this at a minimum. One was that the personal relationship didn't explode and go sideways as things happen with our allies, and that appears to have happened, at least that things did not go sideways on that. That there were some statement of principles, general principles on that, and although they were incredibly vague, I guess you could say there was restatement of principles that had already been stated of denuclearization, the eventual goal on that, and some security for North Korea. And lastly, some steps in that direction to build on later, and those were very, very minimally put forward. In fact, the one that North Korea offered wasn't even in the agreement, but came afterwards about destroying the engine testing facility. Right. On that. So, yeah, we got a little bit out of this, but mostly, as I said at the outset, I think both Kim and Trump got the show that they wanted politically to go forward on that. I think it's a big lift now for the negotiators on both sides to try to narrow the definitions of what's to be expected and to set an agenda going forward. Again, starting with even figuring out what it is that they're trying to negotiate away for nuclear materials, missiles, etc.
Let me read some comments. An email from Eric. I'm hopeful about these developments. Kim and Trump both have big interests in making this work. Furthermore, I welcome the suspension of U.S.-South Korean exercises. The U.S. military has not been a positive influence abroad for a long time. American exceptionalism is hubris. A question from Ike from Ambler. Why is it okay for us to have nukes but not for other countries? John, I might put that to you. Let me read one more comment. Is anyone worried about Trump cozying up to all these dictators and taking over the world? Up to now, the U.S. has been the protector of freedom. It's very worrying to me. The question from Ike, how come if we have nukes, why can't they? John?
Well, Ike is right. It's not acceptable that Russia and the United States have over 90% of all of the nukes still remaining, and that China has a good portion, and the other six countries that have nukes. The idea of the whole nonproliferation treaty was that those nuclear states were supposed to be readily moving toward eliminating all nuclear weapons. We've not done as good a job as that as we need to do, and the last step in that direction was in 2010 with the New START agreement that President Obama worked with Russia. So, yes, he's right on that. It's not right that we have them, but we should recommit to the nonproliferation treaty. That does not mean in the meantime that non-nuclear states should actually spring up and grow. So we need to be doing both, trying to keep states non-nuclear and then getting the nuclear states to focus on their responsibility under Article 6 of the nonproliferation treaty and recommit to that. So you're right. It's hypocritical in one sense, but it's absolutely necessary that we enforce that agreement, don't have any new nuclear states, and get the nuclear states to start reliving their commitment to reducing those, because it's not just a factor of whether you go to war with these weapons. It's the miscalculation that could occur. It's the mistakes that happen. They're dangerous in and of themselves, an existential danger, and we need to reawaken the public about that and get the movement going again for people to insist that we pay attention.
Anything you want to add to that, Trudy?
Yes, I think it's obvious why North Korea should not have nuclear weapons, and I think that anyone who questions that premise based on what the U.S. has or doesn't have is missing the point. This is a regime that has tens of thousands of its own people in concentration camps. This is a regime that has shot missiles that could be nuclear armed over Japan. It has shot down, destroyed South Korean vessels. It has enunciated, at least in its own propaganda, a policy that it should eventually take over the South, as unrealistic as that is. It has starved its own people for no other reason than to maintain power at the top and put all of the revenue that it does have into military means. And a lot of the money that it does have, it has by proliferating nuclear technology to other rogue nations. So the reason that North Korea should not have nuclear weapons is very plain.
Let me just read something from a UN report on human rights in North Korea. This goes back a couple of years, Trudy, to 2014, but this is just a couple of lines here. The commission found evidence of, quote, extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions and other sexual violence, persecution on political, religious, racial, and gender grounds, the forcible transfer of populations, the enforced disappearance of persons, and the inhumane act of knowingly causing prolonged starvation. That's a frightening description of what it's like for many people living in North Korea.
Furthermore, whole families are arrested and put in what can only be described as concentration camps, where basically you are worked to death. There are tens of thousands of people in these camps. And Trump himself, at his State of the Union address, featured an escapee from North Korea and talked about how depraved and hideous the North Korean torture of forced laborers in these camps was. So I think that this adds to the absurdity of treating Kim as if he's a 26-year-old wunderkind in Silicon Valley. It's not that you don't negotiate with such people, but you don't turn them into paragons and publicly praise them with the fulsomeness that Trump did.
John Tierney, the president was asked, what do you, President Trump, expect Kim Jong-un to do about the human rights record regarding the North Korean people? This was at the press conference earlier today, and he says it was discussed briefly, but just briefly compared to all the other issues, obviously denuclearization being the most critical one. How do we factor in the fact that there is just the extreme human rights violations that are going in North Korea?
Well, you can't ever discount it, and it has to be an ongoing conversation, but you can understand that the existential threat to the United States and the rest of the world is the nuclear question. And just like when dealing with Iran, you're not going to get a comprehensive agreement that deals with human rights and with trade and with the nuclear question all at once. So you can understand that they're taking the existential issue of that and trying to deal with that, but they should not, as Trudy said, be at the same time aggrandizing this guy as if he's the epitome of a really solid citizen, and not even mentioning that. When we dealt with Iran, we made clear that we were unhappy with the human rights situation, that that was going to be a future negotiation, that it had to be addressed, and that it wasn't acceptable. And we never made the Ayatollah or the others in the Quds Guards or anybody else that was responsible for human rights violations out to be nice people or applaud them for their behavior. And this is what's really appalling about this, is not only is he walling off and dealing with the nuclear question, he's then almost glossing over the human rights issue and saying such things about this guy that make you believe that he had never done those human rights violations, had nothing to do with them. So it's astounding that he's moving in the way that he's moving, and I don't know what the explanation for that is, other than I just think he doesn't get it, and that, as you know, he loves authoritarian people. I think, you know, he's got to understand whether he has disregard for human beings or he doesn't, but he should be displaying a dissatisfaction and unacceptability of that human rights condition, and making note that this is a further discussion at the appropriate time. We're dealing with the nuclear thing right now, but that is not a forgotten issue and not one that we're going to put so far on the back shelf that we can't bring it up and be strong on it.
Let me see what Mike from New Jersey has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. Hi. Thank you. This is a great show. I just want to say you guys invite some great speakers and commentators here. So, you know,
thanks.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Great.
Yeah. So I want to, you know, offer my opinion as well. So on earlier commentator who mentioned about our troop presence in South Korea, right?
Right.
Okay, so my opinion is that, you know, if you look around the world now, that we are sometimes looked at a world police, that, you know, if we take our passports to around the world, we can perhaps go to Europe and be, you know, feel welcome. But if we go to Middle East, no, that's no good. And South Africa, yeah, well, there's a...
You know, Mike, I'm going to jump in only just because I need you to stay focused. We're talking about North Korea and what happened there, but I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. I think, though, I do agree with your earlier, actually, the emails, that I think with that is there is a – we sometimes also need to do a little bit of self-reflection, that we also have, I think, you know, nuclear weapons, like the earlier email said. But at the same time, I think it is important to put a pressure on North Korea. So I do think that, you know, this meeting may have, you know, underachieved what was expected. But, you know, I think it's a – you know, it is a diplomatic breakthrough for North Korea, but for us, I don't think we've gained much from it.
Well, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. John Tierney, a couple of comments that we've gotten as well, basically saying, you know, why is this in American interest? How come we're the policeman or policewoman of the world? And we have our own track record of foreign policy debacles.
Well, yeah, we do have our own record of foreign policy debacles, and that's for another day, I guess, another discussion on that. We can go through them one by one.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of why is the United States involved, is we have obligations as a nation, a powerful nation, one of the leaders of the world, and a signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Agreement, to make sure that the non-nuclear states remain non-nuclear states and do all that we can do for that. And we have international commitments and treaties with allies that give us the responsibility to step forward and try to make sure that nuclear weapons don't spread and don't proliferate. So that's our involvement in that, and it should be through diplomacy, and we should work in that regard towards making sure that it doesn't happen. Not too many people dispute the fact that we ought to be aggressively trying to work in a diplomatic channel to get rid of nuclear weapons altogether, and that we should be trying to make sure that non-nuclear states do not become nuclear states. And for all of those reasons, it's obvious why we're engaged in this. For the rest of the world, obviously, there are many, many places that where you have a right to question why troops are there. You have a right to question why Congress never voted on putting troops in bases 1,100 plus around the world, and whether or not we're actually doing more harm than good. But that's a much broader conversation on that.
Well, just to pick up on that, let me toss it to you, Trudy. I mean, the G7, its future is uncertain with U.S. participation. TPP, we're not involved. NAFTA, it looks like there certainly are negotiations, totally legitimate, but there might be a question about whether it will survive into the future, the Paris Accord. I'm thinking of all the treaties and deals that the United States had with other countries, including our allies. Are they on the table now?
Well, I just want to make one more point about our troops in South Korea and our alliances in East Asia. I think it's important to point out that were we to do what the North Koreans want, which is to pull back our nuclear umbrella over Japan and over South Korea and pull out our troops, you would have a situation where inevitably Japan and South Korea would go nuclear because they have nuclear threats on their border from China and from North Korea. The only way you're going to be able to have peace between the Koreas is if South Korea feels safe also. And North Korea has openly challenged the future of South Korea. So first of all, you have the risk of more nuclear proliferation in the region. Secondly, we have to look in the future towards the challenge of China. China has done aggression on its borders, has done aggression in the seas surrounding it. And our alliances with Japan and South Korea are a hedge against China. We pull out of the region, China is freer to aggress in areas where we have interests. And when we abandon alliances, that gives the green light to China. So it's not a peaceful world out there. And there are reasons why we have troops abroad. South Korea invited our troops. This was not an invasion.
And not an invasion. We haven't really talked a lot about China, John Tierney, but looking at the agreement such as it is, do you think this will make China happy?
Well, I don't think it's going to make them happy in the sense their early statements are this. They don't think much happened at the summit. They realistically look at it and see that it was a repeat of principles already stated. And generally, they're taking credit for having it happen at all, saying that they were the ones who were instrumental in putting the parties together. I think they probably think it's successful in terms of China's outlook, in that it's lowered the temperature on a nuclear conflict and other conflict that might happen. It now allows them to loosen up on their trade, because they're certainly not going to enforce the sanctions at the same rate they had been. Mm-hmm. So they're going to pick up trade with North Korea, and they're going to get a little bit more influence back that they might have lost when they had a prospect of doing something more substantial. So I don't think that China's upset by what happened at all. I don't think they're impressed by it either.
Trudy?
I would think, however, that China would be happy that Trump unilaterally ended our joint exercises.
Oh.
Because in a sense, he has sent a signal also with his repeated statements at the press conference that he wants to pull out troops. And his emphasis over and over again that he sees this in terms of dollars and cents and not in terms of alliances and values. And this basically makes South Korea look more towards China. They have to hedge. And it ensures that the regime, the Kim regime, stays viable. But mostly it shows China that Trump wants to withdraw from the regions and leave things open to him. Just as Trump's undermining of Western alliances shows Putin that he has an open season in trying to take advantage of those cracks in U.S. alliances.
John, we're almost out of time here. Obviously, it's now Secretary of State Pompeo is essentially in his court to take it from here. Do you have confidence in him?
Well, not particularly. I have more confidence in him than in his past iteration. Since he's become Secretary of State, he seems to be at least indicating that he understands the role of diplomacy a bit more and seems to want to grow into that position. So hesitatingly, I wish him well and hope he moves in that direction and figures out how to do it and get away from some of the bombast that he was known for when he was in Congress. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, I don't think that this particular team is the team to get it done, but we can hope that they are.
Well, that is former Congressman John Tierney. He is the executive director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. John Tierney, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. In fact, we posted on our Facebook page the text, the full text of the summit between Trump and Kim. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.